This is Ozarks at Large. Todd A. Surivel, an archaeologist and the head of the anthropology department at the University of Wyoming, for years practiced archaeology that is commonly called dirt archaeology, carefully digging and extracting information about past civilizations out of the earth. But some of the questions that developed around his field work in the western United States led him to a very different kind of research, observing nomadic people in Mongolia. Earlier this month, Todd came to the University of Arkansas campus to deliver the latest Stigler Lecture in Anthropology and Archaeology at the U of A. During his time here, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio and discussed how his work in Mongolia developed.
And I study people, but usually the people I study are dead, right? They're people from the past. So Mongolia was a huge change for me in that people were still living. This is a project in the field of ethnoarchaeology, so studying living people for the purpose of developing tools for understanding the archaeological record. And the way I made the turn from prehistoric archaeology to ethnoarchaeology was I was working on an archaeological site in Colorado in a place called Middle Park. Mm-hmm. It's a winter campsite. It was occupied at the end of the last ice age around 12,600 years ago. And we were finding thousands and thousands of stone tools, about 75,000 pieces of chip stone. And because the site was shallowly buried and relatively well preserved, we could open up big, big excavations and not only, you know, get all these artifacts, but look at spatial patterns and the arrangement of different kinds of artifacts and different kinds of materials, different kinds of tools. And what was really clear was there were a lot of really, really interesting spatial patterns that I could easily identify in our excavations, but understanding what they meant for past human behavior. I felt like we as archaeologists hadn't really done the homework we needed to do in order to translate from those patterns in the archaeological record to the human behavior that produced them. And in my mind, it inspired some really, really basic questions that I didn't know the answer to, where I wanted to see people, nomadic people, living today and see how they use the space in their campsites, and to think about how those decisions about where they do different activities would translate to an archaeological record in the Stone Age. So once I made that decision, you know, it was a fairly simple process of trying to find a place where I could do that research, you know. And because I was working in the temperate zone in Colorado at basically 7,600 feet in a mountain valley in Colorado, I was looking for a comparable environment and people who are still nomadic today and live a traditional nomadic lifestyle. And there aren't many places in the world where you can do that. Nomadic peoples in the world today really live in, you know, a couple of different environments. There's a fair number of nomadic populations still in the tropics, which does not serve, and in the subtropics, and it's not the best analog to the archaeology I was doing, right? But then in the Arctic, to some extent, you still have that lifestyle, although not to the extent that you used to, and then in the subarctic and of Central to East Asia. So I could have really done this work anywhere from maybe Central Asia, from, you know, Afghanistan all the way up to Russia and Siberia. It was finding the right place and the right people in that space where I could actually do this work. And that's how I landed on Mongolia. You know, it was politically easier than, say, working in Afghanistan or Iran, right? In terms of the paperwork and the red tape bureaucracy, easier than working in Russia, right? I had colleagues who had done archaeology in Mongolia. I chose Mongolia. In Mongolia, you still have quite a few people who live nomadic lifestyle, and some variation of nomadism, usually associated with herding of livestock. I heard that in far northern Mongolia, there was a population of reindeer herders. Most of Mongolia, you know, the livestock that are commonly herded are sheep and goat, camel, horse, and cattle. But when I learned that there were reindeer herders in far northern Mongolia, I thought, I got to see that. That's the place I got to go. And that's how I ended up in the Sayan Mountains near the Mongolian border with Russian Siberia.
How do you work the contacts to go there and then you know, win confidence or approval to observe.
It was really tough, actually.
I imagine.
There's so many hurdles to doing that. You know, I sort of pulled this project out of a hat. I didn't have contacts up there. First thing I did was I tried to learn the language. And Mongolian language in and of itself is really difficult to learn because, one, it's a different alphabet. It's a Cyrillic alphabet, so you need to learn to read and write again. And even more difficult, nobody teaches it. There's only one class, I think it's at Indiana University, has courses in Mongolian language, and I'm not there. I'm at the University of Wyoming. There's no Rosetta Stone, there's no online app or anything for learning Mongolian, right? So first thing I did was I found a graduate student at the University of Wyoming in the botany department, Bujidma Borhu, and she tutored me in the language for a year and a half. And she was a great teacher, and one day I was over at her house getting my Mongolian lesson, and she said, Todd, there's a Dokha family that wants to work with you. Now, the Dokha are these reindeer herders that, you know, I had never met, the people I wanted to go live with and study. And here I am in Laramie, and she says, there's a Dokha family that wants to work with you. And I said, Buji, how's that possible? Well, her older sister's ex-husband, his cousin, was married to a guy whose mother was Dokha, but no longer herding reindeer.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's an interesting place. Mongolia is this gigantic space. You know, it's about the size of Alaska, but it's a relatively small population and very rural and very connected. I mean, there's very much a social network that extends across that entire space, right? So it's through this extended family connection. I was told that there was a family that wanted to work with me. Now, when I arrived for the first time in a reindeer herder camp in the summer of 2012, it wasn't exactly what I was expecting. The welcome wagon wasn't there, and you know, when I walked into the first teepee, what they call an ortsungir, and I was like, "Hey, I'm here," and their response was basically, "Who are you? What?"
that's a difficult place to hear that.
Yeah, after traveling halfway around the world, and I can tell you how difficult it is just to get to that place geographically. They didn't know I was coming. They'd never heard of me. They didn't know what research I wanted to do or why, and they weren't exactly welcoming. And for good reason. I mean, some random person just showed up at your doorstep saying you wanted to study them and collect all this data about you, right, out of the blue. Your reaction would be pretty much the same. So it took a while to develop those relationships. But I find that if you're nice to people and you show genuine interest in them and care about them, then it opens the doors to a lot of things, you know.
How long were you there?
My first field season was the summer of 2012. My last field season was the fall of 2017. And I think in total I had six field seasons over 8 months. So I spent 8 months in the taiga, and every season. I've been there in the heart of winter, spring, fall, summer.
You used the words dirt archaeologist when we began this conversation. What tools and what sort of mental facilities are different for you when you're not looking at dead people, but living people? Was there anything that was the same?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, I'm an archaeologist, so I deal with the material world. We all do. We deal with artifacts. We deal with features like fire pits and architecture. And certainly when I'm, you know, in Mongolia, or really all the time, I'm looking at the material world in which we live. So, a really dumb example, in Wyoming, if you're out in the plains, you find features that we call stone circles or teepee rings. And these are, you know, exactly what they sound like. There may be 20 feet in diameter rings of stone that once held down the edge of a teepee for nomadic plains people. You go to a Dokha reindeer herder camp, they're also living in similar house forms, and you can see teepee rings in use today, which is pretty wild. The basic tools of the research were very different. Recording human behavior as it's occurring in front of you is very different than recording it in the ground archaeologically. And my primary tools of collection, data collection, what I was doing was mapping people as they went about their daily lives. So imagine you're in a reindeer herder camp and you want to know where everybody is and what they're doing, and you want to know that for every, say, in 2 minute intervals with great precision. How do you pull that off? So that was a technical challenge that I had to figure out.
It sounds as if you had to be on all the time.
It felt like that at first, but no. Imagine being in a camp at treeline at, say, 7,000 feet above sea level in the mountains in Mongolia, and you're living in this camp with 8, 9 other people. And the closest other people to you are maybe 25 miles away. It's a pretty relaxed environment once you get accustomed to it. In fact, there's endless free time. So there's lots and lots of time to kill. My data collection methods were such that, you know, when you're living with people in a small group setting like that, one of the most important things is that you don't constantly annoy them, right? You don't want to become a problem. You certainly don't want your presence to affect the way that they're living their life, because that's what you're there to study, you know? So we developed data collection methods that were minimally obtrusive, and, you know, only 5 times a day really was I going into people's houses and collecting data for 20-minute intervals, and that was very much an intentional choice, because imagine if I followed you around with a clipboard every day for a month, right? You'd hate me. You'd want me to go away.
Or right? At least start acting the way I might not normally.
Yes. So in terms of being on, I mean, you're present the whole time, but there's just a lot of hanging out, a lot of downtime, a lot of walking, a lot of hiking, a lot of reading, a lot of trying to figure out things to do. Once you've read everything you brought with you, your cell phone doesn't work, right? It's really relaxing that way, actually.
Did you get some of the answers that were originally formed from your curiosity?
I mean, yes and no.
Yeah.
Let me go back to the archaeological problem and sort of describe, you know, the kind of problem that inspired me to do this work. And then I'll go back to the Mongolian case. One very common thing we find in the archaeological record is something called a hearth-centered activity area. And all that means is there was a fire, right? And people worked around that fire. And in the archaeology I do, which is hunter-gatherer archaeology before food production, very commonly we'll find, you know, fire feature, hearth feature, surrounded by stone tools, because hearths serve as magnets for human activity, because, well, you can use them to cook, they generate heat, they generate light. That's why when we make a campfire, we sit close to it, right? So that basic process is pretty well understood, but imagine now the distribution of stone tools that accumulates around that hearth feature and how it might vary and why. Let's say you want to sit around a hearth feature and make a stone tool. Where are you going to sit, and how are you going to make that decision? How close to it are you going to sit? At what angle? If you repeat that act 100 times, would you always sit in the same place? If it was inside of a house, how would that differ from outside? I didn't know the answer to any of those questions, and yet those really simple spatial decisions that we make about where to do things very much govern the spatial patterning that we see in the archaeological record. And honestly, I still, you know, before I went to Mongolia, I felt nobody knew the answers to those questions. They're really, really, really simple questions. So when I went into, you know, Mongolian households, again, these are teepees, conical lodges, 28 poles and a canvas covering, and one room, circular spaces, right? I didn't really have expectations. I knew what the distributions of stone tools looked like in the sites that I had looked at, and there were some things about them that kind of perplexed me, but I didn't really know how people would use a space like that, how behavior would be mapped onto a space like that. Now I have a really, really good idea, because I've recorded something like 5,000 human locations inside of these houses, and I've done it by age of individual and gender and time of year and time of day and different activities. So now I have a really, really good sense of how people use these spaces and why, and the general factors that govern them. So that part I understand really well now, at least for the Mongolian case, right? The next step, intellectually, logically, is challenging, right? To what extent does what I see in the Mongolian world translate to, say, Colorado 12,600 years ago or any other hearth feature in the archaeological record?
Yeah.
That's the challenging part. But I think there are some basic things that do translate. So here's an example. In the hearth features we looked at in Colorado, three of those hearth features occurred within structures, within houses, right? You wouldn't, the small circular houses of nomadic people, they were possibly conical, maybe dome-shaped, we don't know. The highest densities of artifacts appear to occur in the backs of those houses, away from the door, which I didn't know what that meant. I think I have a better sense now, but again, that kind of pattern inspired these questions, right? So I go to Mongolia, and when I'm there in the summertime, the first thing I notice is that when people are doing things that require the use of tools, like they're sewing or they're making something using scissors, or they're cooking, they're cutting meat, they're actually usually sitting towards the front of the house, which is interesting. It was the opposite of what I was seeing in the archaeological record, right? But then when I went back in the fall of 2014, I noticed a lot of those activities were moving, had migrated towards the back of the house. And what I very quickly realized was that the distribution of certain activities was tracking the amount of light in this houses and in these houses and the distribution of light. So we had brought a handheld light meter so we could measure light across the entire space. And in the summertime, when the door is open, it's really, really bright right in the front of the house. But in the cold season, the door is closed, that becomes one of the darkest spaces in the house. In the back of the house, where the light's coming through the top vent, the back of the house is a little better lit. And it seems really obvious after the fact, right? Like when you think about where you read, you always go to the bright places, right? But then you start to think about, okay, what was the distribution of light in these prehistoric houses and how was that controlling the distribution of activities? And am I actually seeing a seasonal signature here in the archaeological case in terms of where those artifacts are accumulating around those hearth features? So that's one simple example.
When you would come back from a field study and the cell phone worked everywhere, and there was so much, would that be a bit of an adjustment for you?
Such a great question. Yeah, so when I'm up in the taiga in Mongolia, I have no email, you know, no access to email, no text messages, no Facebook, no Instagram. I do get a little news through satellite television. These guys are packing around satellite receivers on reindeer and satellite dishes and things, but it's very isolating, right? And when I'm, you know, when we're done with this interview, no doubt I'm going to pull out my smartphone and check my email, right? So one thing that amazed me always when I came out of the taiga and I got my first Wi-Fi, which was, you know, like a week later when we got to a town called Murung, and I checked my email and there were like 1,500 messages for me, and it seems incredibly overwhelming, right? One thing I recognized was that 99% of them could be ignored. And then I wondered, you know, it makes you wonder, like, why are we doing this all the time? Why are we so attached to this stuff and these forms of communication? And they bring us so much more angst than they do actually convenience. And it was always, it's a great question. It was always so striking to me, like, getting back to the internet was never like this panacea. It was always kind of disappointing.
Todd A. Surivel is an archaeologist, and he is also the head of the anthropology department at the University of Wyoming. This month, he delivered a Stigler lecture on anthropology and archaeology at the University of Arkansas. We spoke with him at the Carver Center for Public Radio.